I'd like to call the meeting to order with a roll call. And again, welcome to the meeting of the Research and Innovation, Legal and Legislative Affairs Committee. Meeting is called to order. Mrs. Wright, would you please call the roll?
Vice Committee Chair Rita Athus.
Here.
Trustee Dennis Barsima.
Here.
Trustee John Butler.
Here.
Trustee Veronica Herrero.
Here.
Trustee Aiden O'Brien. Trustee Leland Strum.
Here.
Committee Chair Eric Wazowicz.
Here.
Board Chair Montel Gales.
Here.
Thank you.
Mr. Perry, would you please confirm that appropriate notice of this meeting has been provided and that we have a quorum present?
Morning, Mr. Chair. You have a quorum present. An appropriate notice has been provided pursuant to the Illinois Open Meetings Act.
Thank you. May I have a motion to approve the agenda as proposed?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Second, Athus.
We have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll call the question. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of our last meeting?
So made, Strum.
Second, Herrero.
We have a motion and we have a second. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll call the question. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Chair's comments. I think that, when you look at RILA and what it stands for, Research, Innovation, Legal, and Legislative Affairs Committee, it's a mouthful. The research and legislative pieces of the committee name seem to be at the top of mind for researchers in higher education these days, and you would need to be living under a rock to know that there is some change happening in the legislative area. I was in Barcelona yesterday, and I was watching the news in Catalan, and which is a language, in case you don't know. And I didn't need to know Catalan to know that legislative and executive orders are a big subject around the world, not just in the United States. So with that said, let's get into the agenda. I want to welcome any university advisory committee representatives present today. Do you have any comments?
I'll be just very brief, hopefully just like three or four sentences. Just I want to say, echoing what you were just bringing up, that there is clearly impacts to campus felt by our staff, our students, our faculty, and I, on behalf of myself and those I represent, I'd like to just commend the responses that are going on, maybe not as visible as some would like, not as out there on our website and other places, but I do know the work that's going on, and I'm sure there'll be conversation about that today, to be supportive, to be on top of, and be engaged in the conversation. So as Faculty Senate President, UC Chair, I just want to make sure that that is heard by this body. So that's all.
And thanks for holding the door for me this morning. I appreciate that. So we recognize members of the public. By the way, does anybody else have anything to say? We're good? We recognize members of the public who have complied with state law and Board of Trustees bylaws by registering their written request to address the board with our parliamentarian. Mr. Perry, you're the parliamentarian. Have you received any timely requests to address this meeting?
We have no public comment this morning.
Okay. At this point, I'd like to ask Vice President for Research and Innovation Partnerships, Richard Murkowski, for news, items, and comments.
Thank you so much, and thank you everybody for being here. I do have a short slideshow that I'd like to go through because I think it's an understatement that the status quo in the research space, research scholarship creative activity, has been upended. As many of you know, the federal government is the primary source of funding for research, and the academy writ large, and as a research institution, we're a big part of this, is the discovery engine of the United States. As such, we're reliant on federal funding, and that landscape is, I say, evolving here. It's rapidly evolving. So on the screen, you'll see a quick timeline of what has happened during the transition to this administration in DC. This started with the Office of Management and Budget freezing all federal spending for a review period on January 28th. This was followed by some technical back-of-the-house things that caused disruption across the country, including the payment management system being shut down so we could not draw down on awards. Just as a quick primer, the majority of awards that we receive at NIU and that researchers across the country receive, and this, I should note, it's not just research. It's research, it's creative activity, it's student support, right? It's everything, right? There's service grants, there's outreach grants. It's more complex. I'm using research as a shorthand. Most of the awards we receive are what we call cost reimbursable. And what that means is we essentially act as stewards of a credit card for the United States government. They've given us a promissory note to say we're going to pay $100,000 for this project, bill us, and then draw down as you get billed. So we, as an institution, use our cash reserves to do these activities that are important to our mission, important to our faculty, staff, and students, and then we ask the federal, we provide evidence to the federal government through the payment management system that we've done the work, and they reimburse us because we have a promissory note. So shutting that down, even temporarily, was a pretty big shock to the system. It was restored relatively quickly, along with an FAQ document that came out to explain the OMB memo, trying to make it seem less overreach, right? They explained that Pell Grants and student loans were not to be impacted that. On the 30th, we had the rescission of the memo, but they did not rescind the underlying executive orders underneath it. And there was a lawsuit from 22 states in the works at that point that was granted a temporary restraining order on the freeze. This is when the news media stopped reporting. It did not stop our clear-eyed view of the fact that this is a big disruption and the threat is still there. This is still in the courts. This is, and we're seeing impacts across our portfolio. On the 7th of February, the next big thing in the research arena happened, which was capping of facilities and administration cost at 15%. I'm going to go into facilities and administration cost in a second and explain that in more detail. Needless to say, this would be another shock to the system should our 52% rate be capped at 15%. It changes the math and how we can support our researchers. We were contacted by the governor's office and we helped support the legal action that I believe there were 24 states on this one submitted and were granted a TRO on this cap. I think it's important to note that we were part of this action and we're continue to be part of these actions as we go forward when it is, frankly, existential crises in these spaces. Next slide, please. Just to give a snapshot of where we are as an institution, these are in thousands. This is our federal funding portfolio. As you'll notice, we're indexed highly in the Department of Energy and the National Science Foundation. Most of the work we're doing on this campus in research and creative activities is, well, all of it from the federal government perspective is peer reviewed. The process is long, it's laborious. We've talked about how successful we are at that rate. That 28% number that I cited as the national average, that includes all sources. At the federal level, it's more like 9%. So to get a grant from a federal agency, our faculty put in hours of work based on years of research, and then it is peer reviewed by multiple folks and put in competition. It is a labor of love, but also a labor of labor. And it is not the science, creative activity, everything that's funded, none of it's a gift. It is all based on actual hard work by experts in the field, and we're proud of our faculty for doing that. And I think it's important that that message is out there. This is not the federal government gave money to NIU as a gift. No, this is a contract to help advance the United States' interest in research, scholarship, creative activity, supporting our country's ecosystem of research, which is, frankly, been the envy of the world and has created many innovations that have made our lives easier, that made our lives more equitable, and made a more just world over the last 50, 60, 70 years that this has been the engine of discovery. Next slide. Thousands of dollars, yes, sorry. Next slide, please. Now there's two parts to a grant. There's the direct cost, so we put in a proposal to do an engineering experiment with Fermilab, and we're going to do prototyping. That's gonna include personnel costs, that's gonna include supplies costs, that's gonna include potentially some travel, everything to support that. There's a whole apparatus on the other side that is supporting that, that the institution has been invested in. This is called facilities and administration costs, administrative costs, sorry. Sometimes this is called indirect cost or overhead. These are real costs that are not readily identified with a particular project or activity, but they're necessary for the general operation of the university and conduct of the activities, right? We negotiate this rate. It's everything from my staff in RIPS to staff in the colleges, lab safety, the lights in a lab, you know, purchasing of equipment, maintaining equipment. It's real, and the numbers that you see on the screen, 52% for our organized research rate, we didn't make that number up. We spent, I don't want to know how many hours, but more hours than we can count every 3 to 6 years negotiating this with the federal government. In fact, we negotiated with the Department of Health and Human Services, as do 92% of all other negotiated rates are with DHHS, which is who put in the cap. These costs are real, and the reimbursement of these costs are what helps support a vibrant research culture on campus. Because without them, we cannot ensure compliance, we cannot ensure safety, and frankly, reinvestment into the faculty, staff, and students who are doing this amazing work to take the next big swing, to try to make that new discovery that will help make the world a better place. Next slide. Let's talk about the positives. What are we doing now? It's roll up our sleeves time, right? So what are our proactive measures? We initially did a risk assessment identifying all programs with federal funding sources, and we've been working with the PIs, the principal investigators, should be faculty or staff, who are responsible for these funds. Of those grants that we feel like are at the highest risk, we've started there, talking to them about what their responsibilities are and making sure we have a clear line of communication should there be any changes. This includes making sure we're compliant, making sure we know where we are on the budget burn rates, the spend, making sure the project's on track. Beyond that, we are in the midst, and Ben, I hope this will be the more vocal piece that you all are looking for. We've partnered with Academic Affairs. Oh, please go back one slide. We've partnered with Academic Affairs, Advancement, OERD, and RIPS to begin the process of a rapid pivot. Groups. The idea of this is to work with our faculty to identify our research strengths beyond what we already know, to find cross-cutting collaborations, and to work across disciplinary lines to diversify our funding sources. That does not mean we are abandoning the federal funding apparatus. We obviously should continue to apply for federal funding. We have quite a bit of state funding, but it's increasing foundation and corporate support in ways that we think will benefit the region, both economically, but also benefit our faculty, as it will allow them to continue to do the work and see those real results pay off in the world, frankly, more quickly. So excited about this, working very quickly to get this launched, and hopefully have forums either next week or the week after, open forums for faculty to start engaging with these teams, and then starting that work of figuring out the mechanisms to engage with corporate and foundation support. And there's a number of different models we're looking at, and we're excited about that. Next slide, please. We do have an up-to-date website with current guidance for all federal awardees. This is something we'll continue to message out. Anytime there's a change or guidance that comes out, it goes on this website. It's keeping track of everything that happens at the federal level. just as a portal, so we don't have to send an email every, you know, 12 hours or so when something changes. Next slide, please. And then we are, senior leadership has been working together to have a prioritization plan should funding be stripped in different areas, to better understand what we can do if we have internal funds to help bridge those programs. What's the centrality of students, centrality to our mission? What's the grant status, right? There's a difference between losing a grant in its fifth year of 5 years with $3,000 less than losing a grant that's in its first year of 5 years that has promises to students. And understanding that's important for the sort of risk matrix. The impact on campus of the lost funding, the availability of other funding sources, how can we help do that? Again, we're trying to be proactive there. And the program track record, right? Has the program been compliant? Has the program been on track? Are there other risks that we're exposed to? Next slide. And as I said earlier, and I'll close with this, you know, we're working with partners from around the country to monitor the situation, but also to contribute to actions where needed. We're proud that we're working with the state of Illinois to lend our voice in the impact on our campus for the last temporary injunction that was filed. But we're in a unique position in that we are a research institution, but we have partners in the state who we know are in the same position and are willing to be our partners. We also are very fortunate to have Dara Little as the president of one of the two research administration national organizations, so she has her ear to the ground, and our folks in DC are doing amazing work. So we're not gonna sit back and just be passive recipients of information. We're gonna be out there trying to figure out the best course forward to, frankly, create a foundation for our faculty. All right, last slide, just any questions?
Richard, that's amazing, by the way. I mean, I think everybody's sitting here thinking and wondering and everything else, but putting that out there like that, I think is just awesome stuff. So thank you for that. Also, we met beforehand, and you know, you were talking about our diversified revenue streams, which in any business, if you're operating it, you don't want more than 20% coming from one area. So, but I think you've given us a kind of a good view. Can you talk a little bit about the diversified revenue streams?
Right, we are indexed heavily in federal, but honestly, it's not, in our realm, we think of it more, there's only really four types of sources. So drill down further, mm-hmm. to get into, you know, NASA or DOE, those kinds of things. But when we think about it in the buckets at the higher level of federal, state, corporate, and foundation, most folks, if we're being honest, are over 50%, more like 60 or 70% of federal. We are just under 50% of federal. So we have strong state support and some foundation and corporate support. And the goal here is to grow those latter two categories. We have, you know, I guess I had the good fortune of having worked in Silicon Valley at an institution that did this pretty well. And in working with industry, in understanding that working with industry is a different conversation than working with the federal government. It's not, here's a program, what's the holistic way we can approach it, may the best applicant win. It's more, how does this advance both our missions?
Yep.
And what's the value proposition of the sponsored research or program to the industry or the business partner? And so that's what we're working for, and we'd like to see, frankly, that industry support grow to more like 15 to 20%. It's quite a bit under that right now.
But we're adjusting,
yeah. And just to be clear, this was already in the plan. It just, we're accelerating the plan. This was like next August, let's launch, how do we incrementally get better in this space? This is, okay, we have faculty who, even if we haven't lost a grant for a faculty member, I have faculty who have lost opportunities already. So they've shut down programs already proactively. So it's not, we're taking this money away, it's, I was going to apply for that grant and that RFP is no longer available. So those faculty now need support in other spaces and they're doing amazing work. So we feel like we can help partner with them. And I've been it's a testament to the teams across the institution that everybody's willing to roll up their sleeves and help in this space.
Cool. President Freeman.
I just want to add a couple of things. First, I want to echo the gratitude for Richard and Dara and RIPS, the Research Development Office, and everybody being so great about sharing information immediately with the Attorney General's office and the Governor's office, and you know, wringing their hands for only a minute before they rolled up the sleeves to try to figure out how to better support our faculty. But I also want to make the point that this is an effort to offer our faculty options so that they can continue to have an impact on society, do the great work that they've always wanted to do, engage our students. But we respect and support our faculty's academic freedom to choose their research questions. It's just that they're now going to have fewer options from the federal government, who has been the largest supporter of fundamental research. And our folks are going to do everything that they can to help our faculty continue to do what they want to do with resources that are available from outside the university. So I just want to be very clear, RIPS is not redirecting faculty research. They're not forcing industry partnerships that are an anathema to what the faculty believes in. They're doing what they've always done, except at warp speed in very challenging conditions, to help our faculty be successful. And at the same time, the state of Illinois is being an excellent partner to the university in crafting legal strategies to oppose overreach and, frankly, illegal actions that are being taken to stop the flow of federal money and to force compliance with what is not law.
Dennis?
Two questions. The 15% cap on administrative overhead, was there an explanation as to the rationale of how they arrived at that number?
There was. It didn't hold a great deal of logic. So in the notice, they cited a number of private foundations that capped their indirect cost rates in university, including the Gates Foundation as one example. And universities are willing to take the funds from those organizations to do the work and essentially voluntarily cost share the remaining indirect cost. Within the notice itself, they cited three universities that do not do this. They will not take these grants. All three universities have come out with a statement saying that's it was inaccurate, that's not true, they misread their websites, they take money from Gates and everybody else. So it wasn't well crafted in that way. Essentially, they took on the operative logic that indirects are not real, that F&A is not real. And they tried to back it up with some cherry-picked examples of foundations and then these three institutions, again, all of which is said, what you said is not true. They're big institutions, too. They're all major research institutions. So I do find it ironic that they would choose the National Institutes of Health as the first organization, since their parent organization is doing the majority of the negotiating. One piece I didn't mention about F&A is we already have a capped side of it, so 26% for administration costs, and then facilities costs is the other side of that equation. So we're already supplementing. They've already capped side of it. They capped that in, what, 97? Mid-90s, sorry, before my time. But and that cap has not moved, even as it's gotten more expensive, as we saw in the last RILA meeting when ABP Little presented the amount of federal compliance requirements has exponentially gone up while the support on facilities administration has not changed. So that's a long way of saying they had reasons, but the reasons were either faulty or cherry-picked. Yeah.
So
can I add something again? I'm sorry, but I can't help myself here. For anyone who's read the history of science in this country, It is a well-documented trail of historical documents that shows that coming out of World War II era, there was a deliberate decision of the federal government to cost-share facilities on university campuses for the purpose of allowing fundamental research to flourish across our country. And the facilities and administrative component of grants was the federal government's commitment to maintaining strong science infrastructure for the national prosperity and defense. And this is a revocation of that commitment that was made so long ago and that has had so much success in making America as great as it is.
I agree 100%, Dr. Freeman, but to also kind of compound on one of the things that you said, that, you know, as the sands shift out of Washington relative to funding for research and such, coming from the Valley, you were there, I was there for a number of years as well, and I still have a group of former CEOs who we, you know, we talk on a fairly frequent basis now, that the thought is that private companies are going, well, public companies are going to step up at some point in time and start funding research that perhaps the federal government is allowing to drop on the floor. You've got a number of companies who are sitting on billions and billions and billions of dollars of cash, right? And so in their quest to be good citizens to the world, right, what is their responsibility relative to helping fund some of the research that perhaps Washington is no longer going to fund? Have you had, and again, this is just pontificating on our part, it's not based upon any science at all that we have, or inside knowledge that we have of what these companies are going to do, but have you heard of any discussion of private companies stepping forward to fill the gaps?
In short, no. And I think one of the things that is part of my belief in the research enterprise in this country, and I've said it at this table before and I'll say it again, is the academy, and President Freeman, I think, rightfully points out the history of this, but the academy is the last nonprofit engine for discovery. And I think it's really important to frame the nonprofit piece of it. One of the things that the academy does well when working with industry is on the applied side, when we're ready, and part of the engine of academic research is allowing corporations to flourish, because the basic R&D that is high risk, really high risk, high failure rate, is not going to be funded by any company, because who would expect that studying the oils in a Gila monster in 1984 would lead to Ozempic in 2022? That is not an investment a pharmaceutical company would make, because that wasn't the question they were asking in 1984. They just wanted to understand the properties of that particular secretion, because nobody had studied it before. And it took, you know, almost 40 years to realize it, but the R&D was all funded by the National Institutes of Health and National Science Foundation in this case, right? And some from Canada too. There was an international piece there. But I don't go into trying to offer another option for our faculty with industry naively thinking that we are going to fill the gap that the federal government might leave. But I do believe there are models that have been working. I'll call them industry-sponsored centers, membership models that allows for that nonprofit piece to still work, because it is a relatively small investment from a corporation standpoint to join together as an industry to fund the fundamental stuff. And you know, we've seen this work in when it's sponsored by the federal government, so the National Science Foundation, IUCRC, which of which we have one under review right now, where It's a membership model for corporations to join the National Science Foundation to fund something particular. In our case, it would be for our Hale research group, right? And the insurance companies have a vested interest. What they're funding is piloting of high-risk fundamental research. And to them, their commitment, which is not six figures a year, but close to it, it's a drop in the bucket, as you mentioned. Those are the kinds of things I think we can partner on. I don't think there's a world in which the fundamental research is going to, we're going to be able to fill the fact that in the first 2.5 months of this year, the National Institutes of Health have funded $1 billion less research than they did last year.
Any other thoughts, Rita?
Quickly, first of all, I want to applaud you, your team, and of course our president, for taking a proactive approach on this. Looking at it more, what the long-term impacts are, what is this going to do to the recruitment of graduate students? Or how are students going to feel coming into a field where there's so much uncertainty about the future?
That's a really great question, and honestly, I think it's incumbent upon us to essentially make sure the positive side of this is still a positive environment. One of the things that's great about NIU is this is a crisis, and I don't see anybody receding from the fight. I see everybody ready to defend and to lean into our values and our goals and our mission. And if I were 22 years old again, I think I would...
You're not?
No. I think I would be excited by that prospect. Every single person on our faculty spent an inordinate amount of time becoming an expert in a field. And every single member of our faculty could be working in industry if they wanted to. But they choose to be here because they're passionate about it, and that's infectious to our students. And so I think it's an opportunity to create that space of positivity, even in spite of the challenges. There's always going to be challenges. So I hope we can be bright star for those new graduate students, and I think our faculty are up to the challenge.
If I can just offer a comment, I mean, I'm living a lot of this myself, my day job. And I think what I heard someone say the other day that I thought was really helpful is to be an activist today is to be focused and more focused on what you know you've done well and on your mission. Because if we worry too much about what might happen, you lose focus. So I think that there's a lot of wisdom in that, in thinking like, yeah, we need to prepare, we need to do a risk assessment and all of that. But I think things are going to change. I mean, just everything is going to shift over the next few years. Others may take on different responsibilities and that maybe the government doesn't want to take on right now. For the next several years, I think everything is going to shift, and I believe that all of us across the country are going to understand the value in what we do, and there will be those who will stand up to fill the gap. So I don't even want to think about how this may impact graduate enrollment, because I think what we do is so important, and it is the value that we bring is. You can't argue with it. You just can't. And I think that over the next few years, we're going to see things change and things may look different. But I think we will continue to deliver on our value proposition. Our students will. Our faculty will. It just might look different. But trying to right now imagine what that will look like, I think is a tall order, and I don't think anyone can do that. So I thank you as well for being so organized and practical in your thinking about this. We have current facts, but there's still a lot of questions, and we're dealing with the facts and preparing for different scenarios. But I just think that I would rather us focus on, again, just being focused on what we do really well, because we'll get through this. I do believe we will.
I just want to thank both of you for those comments and your positivity, and in this crazy world, I have a little bit more comfort.
Lee?
Appreciate the overview of this, Richard, and the discussion, and agree with a lot of it. You know, in the agricultural world, we're watching this very closely, too. Everything from USAID to USDA, and the impacts are immense. I guess, Richard, I'm wondering, as to address this issue about how it might affect graduate, I'm assuming the universities, the institutions of higher education here in Illinois are speaking with a unified voice. Were they all on the agreement on the TRO involvement? So, I mean, I'm assuming we aren't disadvantaged here within the state against our other institutions. But I'm wondering, on a national scale, is there going to be differentiation that may occur that would disadvantage one region versus another on this?
That's a good question, and honestly, I don't have a good answer for it. I would say that right now, we seem to be seeing different messages from different states, but not different messages from the academy. So schools in red states where their officials have said one thing have actually been pretty vocal of the impact this will have on them. So I'm not sure if there's going to be a sorting that happens from this. I will say that we're fortunate to be in a state that does support higher education, right? I've been in other states, and I've seen the amount invested in faculty and in students, and I feel proud of what we do here. And I think it's really, yeah, it's focused on the mission and the value that we bring to our students and the region. And if that's a differentiator and we can help more students who maybe feel disenfranchised in other states, then great. I do think the whole system, though, is we're all pulling together, right?
When you say the system of higher ed,
right? Like my friends in Tuscaloosa, right? I have a couple degrees from Alabama. I feel for them, and I'm talking to them, and I want them to pull through this too. And this is impacting them just as much as it's impacting us.
I want to just add to that. You know, I think we're all talking about the passion we have for higher education as an engine of students' social and economic mobility, and as an engine of creative thought and exploration and innovation and research. But we are anchor institutions, and we have tremendous economic impact on our local communities, on our regions. And, you know, the American Council on Education has started a new campaign, and it's called Higher Ed Builds America. And I think that in the end, the story that we need to tell, as support may be withdrawn capriciously or with questionable criteria, is that we are employers and we drive our local economies. And without us, many regions of the United States that are spread across the United States are going to suffer mightily.
That reminds me of something that I've heard a million times, which I love, which is, if you want a great community, build a university and wait 100 years.
John, you had a comment?
Thank you. I think this is an outstanding conversation. And I was curious how the subject was going to be addressed in the meeting. And I'm very, very impressed with the level of information and the fact that you have found a language to talk about this. At the same time, I think we're in a state of incredible misrecognition of the work that public universities do, and we are having ascribed to us identities and motives that are incongruous with the work that we do. And this disregard, this misrecognition, is something that's going to require of us a new language. And it's a language that will also need to be tangible and understandable to some of those who supported the current administration. And I think that we have to convey who we are and what we do. And I know there's a number of people who do this on a regular basis as part of their job, part of their roles on the national level. We just need to keep working on that language. And we're about to hear a federal relations report. This could dramatically change the business of federal relations for a public university. And we've seen those dramatic changes before when earmarks went out and it became about agency relationships. And so we know how to make those changes, but from a language standpoint, we have to find a way to communicate what we do and why it's valuable. And I like where we're headed with that, but we just need to keep in mind that a lot of the people that we're going to be communicating with have bought into these representations of what happens on a college campus, that we need to work to correct that, to alter that perception.
Any other thoughts, comments? Montel, you've been quiet down there at the end. I'm a little worried. So
I'm quiet out of frustration to some degree, out of fear to some degree. And the one thing I don't want to do, and I don't want to leave the impression with everyone in this room, that fear will be the way out of this thing, because fear brings about paralysis. And this is not one of those kind of deals where we sit on the sideline. We all have to participate in order to make sure that we have a different outcome.
Okay. Well, with that said, one thought comes to mind here. Don't ever let emotion get in the way of the facts. So there's a lot of emotion that comes up, but there's a lot of factual things we're talking about here. So again, thank you for a great report and your comments. And with that, we will move on to the university reports. And agenda item 7A, the state legislative report. Katie Davidson, you're here somewhere in the virtual world. There you are. You're on.
Thank you. I would also just like to take the opportunity to thank Richard and the RICS team, as well as President Freeman, for their rapid response to the governor's requests regarding these issues and the impact that it has on the university, providing that timely, measured, and relevant responses to the state just continues to elevate the university as a valuable partner in advancing research and informed decision-making for the state. So thank you all very much for that. Well, good morning from Springfield. I appreciate the opportunity to provide a supplemental update to the written report that's included in your board packet today. Yesterday, Governor J.B. Pritzker delivered his State of the State address and released his fiscal year 2026 budget proposal. In his remarks, the governor highlighted the Aim High Husky Pledge as a program of note and outlined several key investments and policy proposals that will directly impact our institution and the state's higher education system. The governor's budget includes a 3% increase in general operating funds for higher education that translates to an appropriation recommendation of $103.7 million for NIU. We appreciate the governor's commitment to prioritizing higher education even during a difficult budget year. And while this increase supports our efforts to maintain financial stability, it still does not fully offset historic funding shortfalls and the rising operational costs. Moving forward, we must continue to advocate for long-term sustainable funding solutions that enable us to invest in academic excellence, student support, and faculty resources. The governor's budget reauthorizes previous capital improvements and capital renewal projects, allowing us to move forward with critical infrastructure updates. We will continue to advocate for the Capital Development Board to advance these projects without delay and push for ongoing support to address deferred maintenance needs. Investing in infrastructure, as you all know, is not just about maintaining buildings, it's about providing students with high-quality learning environments and ensuring that NIU remains a competitive and innovative institution. We will remain actively engaged with state leaders to keep these projects moving forward. The governor has also proposed an additional $10 million for MAP, bringing the total funding to $721.6 million and raising the maximum student award to $8,604. NIU has long been a strong advocate for expanding MAP funding, and this investment enhances our ability to recruit and retain students who rely on these critical financial aid resources to access higher education. A significant policy shift that the governor's address is the proposal to allow community colleges to offer four-year bachelor's degrees in select high-demand fields, including nursing, early childhood education, and advanced manufacturing. While the stated intent is to expand workforce development and increase access, this proposal presents a challenge that requires our active engagement. As Provost Elish Piper highlighted during the academic affairs portion of this meeting, NIU has been a leader in degree accessibility by developing community college pathways and partnerships, offering successful degree programs on community college campuses that align with industry workforce demands. Rather than duplicating programs, we will advocate for expanding these partnerships to further strengthen pathways to degree completion. We have legislation that outlines a process for public universities to offer degree completion programs on community college campuses, and we will continue to push this policy pathway as negotiations take place. In a budget briefing prior to the governor's address, when asked, Deputy Governor for Education Martin Torres clarified that community colleges would be responsible for funding their own baccalaureate programs with no state appropriations available for program development. Given the fiscal and political challenges facing the state, it's critical that funding decisions remain focused on the efficient use of limited state resources. This policy proposal comes at a time when our universities and advocacy groups are actively engaging in funding formula negotiations for the four-year public universities in Illinois. President Freeman continues to advocate for a rational funding formula in meetings with legislators and higher education leaders to ensure the formula addresses existing funding gaps in Illinois and at NIU. She will be in Springfield next Wednesday for the next round of negotiations. Also next Wednesday, over 60 NIU students, faculty, staff, and alumni will be participating in our fourth annual NIU Advocacy Day in Springfield. The agenda for the day includes a panel discussion with NIU-affiliated legislators, Senator Sue Resnick and Representative Marie Brial. Meetings will also take place with legislators in their offices, and participants will have an opportunity to tour the state capitol. In addition to these advocacy efforts, I'm actively tracking over 700 bills that could impact the university and have begun sending legislation to campus for input and feedback. I will continue to monitor developments and provide updates to campus. Thank you, and I would welcome any questions at this time.
Any questions for Katie? Montel?
Katie, when we do those legislative visits, do we have a strategy that we go through before we sit down with folks that, you know, do we have individuals that are directed at asking this question, that question, so that it's all coordinated?
Yes. In fact, we're having training tonight with our volunteers that will be attending. How we typically do it is we connect, we create groups of participants who have a lead that from the group that's someone who's been to Advocacy Day before that is very well versed in our priorities, and then we have specific talking points that we outline for them that they bring with them, and then we have lead behind material that they provide to all of the legislators. So yeah, it's very, very coordinated, and being our fourth year, I think we've gotten it down to somewhat of a science. So
thank you.
Anyone else? Any questions for Katie? Katie, what's the temperature in Springfield?
It's cold. But next Wednesday, Advocacy Day, it's going to be almost 60 degrees. So,
good work. How'd you make that happen? Wow.
Weather shift.
Okay. Yeah, I imagine the legislative temperature is up, but the physical temperature is down.
It's down. That's right.
All right. If there are no other questions for Katie, we'll move on. Thank you, Katie. Appreciate your time. Let's move on to agenda item 7B, the Federal Relations Report. So reaching back out into the virtual universe, Ms. Julia Rowe, hopefully joining us here.
I am not able to turn my video on. Oh.
Yep, there you go. We'll give it another try. Sometimes the... Yeah, we can hear you, then that's okay. You need a bigger pipe for the video, so. Why don't you just go ahead, Julia, that's fine. We know what you look like.
Okay.
Tired.
Began a legislative session in January. Speaker Mike Johnson, the new Speaker of the House, and Senator John Thune was elected majority leader. The Secretary of Education designee Lyndon McMahon's nomination hearing was last week. Higher education was not a focus of the hearing, as it typically is not. However, McMahon restated her support for short-term Pell and said that she had not shut down the Department of Education without approval of Congress, which is what's currently needed. Her confirmation vote in the entire Senate is expected in the next couple of weeks. Fund appropriations update, Congress had passed a second continuing resolution in December to fund the government through March 14th at FY24 levels. They still need to fund the government for the remainder of 2025. The House and Senate are working on passing budget reconciliation bills. Budget resolution bills for a budget reconciliation process to pass key pieces of President Trump's priorities, including major tax cuts. Not looking to fund the government for FY25 quite yet. Legislative update, President Trump signed into law the Lincoln-Riley Act in January, and the bill requires the Department of Homeland Security to detain non-U.S. nationals who may be arrested for certain crimes, really expanding that portion. And moving into the administrative really update, where a lot of action has taken place. President Trump has signed over 60 executive orders since taking office, the most of any president in the first 100 days. They cover a broad range of issues, immigration, the economy, DEI, gender ideology, and many other topics. He's rescinded several of the Biden administration executive orders. Of note for NIU was one establishing a White House working group and better the coordination between the federal government Hispanic-serving institutions. As we mentioned, of the federal funding freeze, only released guidance, and there's been a temporary restraining order on the 28th. Richard was actually on the Hill that week, which was very helpful. We had key meetings with members of the delegation and discussed NIU's research and the importance of federal investments. I worked with our Senate offices, as well as Congressman Underwood's office, to explain the full impact to NIU and where our concerns were in providing them with data on how best to be able to serve Illinois. There has been a number of legal challenges to Trump policies that impact NIU. On January 9th, a U.S. District Court in Kentucky ruled that the Biden administration's Title IX rule exceeded the department's authority, rolling back the Title IX nationwide, so the 2020 Trump-era rule is in effect, as it has been annoying for quite some time. I won't go over that in my lawsuits again, as Richard covered. I worked closely with BIPs and provided data to our Illinois delegations to ensure they understood the impact of the NIH FNA cuts to NU. And urged several of them, and they did send on to a dear colleague letter that was sent to HHS urging them to reverse the decision. Our delegation members were really appreciative of the group's impact and information that they provided so that they had data to inform them of what is happening in the state. Another lawsuit that has been filed on student data the University of California Student Association has filed suit against the acting secretary of education after it was reported that DOGE has gained access to sensitive student data and borrowed data. A temporary restraining order was denied and it took place last week. And finally, the National Association of Diversity Equity Officers of Higher Education sued Trump and several federal agencies, including the Department of Education, over an executive order that targeted diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in the public and private sectors. The plaintiffs have argued that it violates the Fifth and First Amendments and threatens academic freedom, and a hearing took place on that order yesterday. A lot has been going on, so that is pretty high level what's been happening. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Julia? Montel?
Effect that will have on our status as a Hispanic serving institution if we maintain that status with what effect that will have from the federal government.
I'm sorry, I think that's the first part of your question.
I guess I'm concerned about our current status as at least as a Hispanic serving institution under the path that the federal government is on today. What effect will that have on this institution maintaining that status, and or is it going to evolve into something different?
Montel, maybe since Julia's connection is choppy and I've attended several webinars and presentations on this in the last couple of weeks, I can speak to what is mostly unknown. The designations of minority serving institutions are statutory. So acts of Congress would be required to repeal many of the programs, but that doesn't mean that the programs could not be defunded or weakened without congressional action. There is a belief across higher education experts who lobby Congress that HBCUs are well situated and the other minority serving institutions are in more peril in terms of their stability, and that would include not only Hispanic serving institutions, but the institutions that are predominantly Black or the ones that are Anapizi or tribal colleges and universities, particularly the ones where a designation like the one that we would be seeking based on our status as an emerging HSI is based on a percentage of enrolled students. For us, becoming a Hispanic serving institution has always been about serving students, not enrolling students at a quota. And so we will continue to take all of the measures that we take to serve Hispanic serving Latinx students as well as all Huskies, because we know that when we meet students where we are and we support their success and enable their dreams, we're doing the right thing for the university, for the students, for Illinois and the country. So it's possible that the designation may go away officially. It's possible that access to some of the resources may dry up, but we are committed to serving all of our students.
Thank you for that.
John?
Is it appropriate to discuss at this point the Dear Colleague letter in any manner as to what we might think we need to be thinking about in response? Is there any knowledge of what is happening with the other institutions in response?
We actually have some pending litigation where we're going to discuss the Dear Colleague letter in that context.
All right, thank you. Appreciate that.
Okay. Anyone else? Any thoughts? So, yeah, Julie, maybe at some point in time you can explain to me what professional wrestling has to do with running the Department of Education, but we'll leave that for another time. If there are no other questions, then thank you, Julia.
Thank you.
And we'll move on to agenda item 7C, sponsored program administrative quarterly report. Dara? I'm sorry, it's a written report. Sorry. Okay. Were there any questions on that? The written part. Okay.
Hi.
Yes, Dennis.
So if I
read this correctly, we're up significantly over where we were last year, 100%.
Yes.
Am I right on that? You did read it correctly.
We're almost 100%, like 88%, something in that range. Yes, we've had
Ranging off of the last conversation that we had relative to what's going on in Washington, of the $44 million that we have on this graph right now, how much of that would you say is at risk, if any of it?
Our assessment of risk, if you look at what we would consider moderate and higher, is roughly a third of federal funding. So that'd be half of this, so 15%. And that's back of the envelope math. So, you know, we can do a deeper dive, but we think roughly a third of the federal, the signals they're giving, roughly a third of federal funding is what's at risk.
And of the 44 million that's on here, how much of that is federal?
Dara, is it about 40%-ish?
Microphone.
Sorry, you got to make a walk. Yeah,
yeah. I was trying to get you up there. I mean, I missed the written part.
So I'd say about a half of that right now is federal, but just to clarify, part of the reason that we do have the spike, and we are up, as Richard said, to date, we are about 80% of where we ended last year, which is good. But part of the reason that you see the significant increase in the written report is that a number of the state contracts that run on the university's fiscal year were received earlier in this fiscal year. So that does account for a pretty good portion of the portfolio there.
But so when you look at the figure one, FY25 quarter two funding level comparison, the number that to me represents stable change is the blue number, because that doesn't come in through state. It's not statutory state contracts. It's not going to fluctuate. The dates aren't going to fluctuate. It's pretty consistent. So that research number, that is probably our truer reflection. We were projecting to be up because we've been up. How much have we been up over the last 5 years, roughly? I can't remember off the top of my head. Was it 88% over 5 years?
Oh, there's so many figures.
That sounds right. It's about 88% over five, and that number continues to climb. So we expect it to be up this year anyway. The fact that, you know, we have done over 44 million and we did 56 million last year in the whole year, some of that's being driven by those statutory state contracts, but not all of it.
Right. And I don't know if we should add that we do know within that research is up as well this year and continues to trend upwards.
Yeah, and that's what I was referencing, those blue lines, that research number is probably a better indicator of our growth rate.
That's good.
So, again, to repeat what I think I heard, and correct me if I'm wrong, of the 44 million that's in so far, roughly half of that is federal, and of that, a third of it might be at risk. Might be at risk.
Based on the three executive orders that were
based
in the first.
The executive orders we know so far are all being challenged in court.
Correct.
But if I can just make sure I understand, these are what we're looking at in that chart of FY25 quarter two funding level comparisons, is what has been awarded in that in quarter two. It's not year to date. Or active grants?
It is year to date.
It's the first two quarters. Active grants? It's just awarded.
No, it's just what has been awarded this year. Active grants.
Some of
it's
coming early, you said.
Yes.
Right.
So there may be.
That's more green than blue.
There may be active grants that are at risk but weren't awarded that are here.
100%.
Yes.
So we have over 200 federal grants.
Yes.
And right in active federal grants, and we have identified roughly a third that we think are at moderate to high risk of not necessarily being taken away or clawed back, right, because it's a legal process, but are not the priority of this administration.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
But let me not go without saying, this is great. So, Barbara, Richard, thank you very much. Doing a great job. I mean, these are tremendous numbers. So, you know, and as we've all been saying, we will continue to fight the good fight.
Thank you.
I think that, you know, what I always tell folks is we have to continue to be the example of what we want the world to be. And so we will continue to do that.
John?
I would just add on this note, I'm not sure this is germane to the item, but I'm grateful that as a board, we have this committee and we have this level of dialogue with the institutional leadership that's overseeing sponsored projects, technology transfer, these sorts of university endeavors, because I would suspect that that's not the same across the higher ed landscape, that a board has made it a point to keep as close as we are to this work. And so as a result, we understand what's happening and the impact it can have on so much of what we do, not just our finances, but our culture and our capacity to offer meaningful employment to faculty, et cetera, so I'm glad that we're situated the way we are, and I thank the institution for its willingness to keep us as well informed as you do.
Well, and I love the discussion we had before about stretching ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. And I think in this environment, that's even more necessary. I think you're tracking along the, you know, the perfect mindset of what we need right now, which is let's be bold and let's go where we may not have thought we were able to go before, but let's go there because we have the talent, we have the abilities, we have it. You know, let's go.
Trustees, I'm getting some texts that please remember to turn on your mic, and if your mic is turned on, to speak into your mic because we're having trouble online hearing. Thank you.
What? Anything else? Okay. Well, with that said, we will now move on to the faculty presentation. We have Dr. Nicholas Pullman, professor from the Department of Mechanical Engineering in the College of Engineering and Engineering Technology. And he'll provide a verbal presentation on accelerating student opportunities through emergent collaborations. Nicholas, welcome.
All right, thank you very much. Just making sure the slide advancer is gonna work. All right, I appreciate the fact that you invited me this week out of a bit of serendipity. It is National Engineers Week, and so we wanna highlight the fact that engineering-
Oh, we knew that already, yeah. Well,
of course we did. What I want to discuss today is to do it as a parallel story to tell between my success and a student who's now an alumnus success. And so I want to introduce to you Luke Martin, who you see on the screen, where we both took some pictures when we first started at NIU, myself 17 years ago, and Luke when he transferred to NIU as a former athlete who was coming into NIU to explore and trying to understand what in the world was going to happen with regard to his student experience. And so I want to relate that to the research endeavor that's part of it. My own history, I have to acknowledge in terms of opportunity, Dr. Jerry Blasey and Dr. David Hedin, both from physics, are the ones that opened the door for me 17 years ago and made it a welcoming environment. I was able to do that for Luke, who came in as an honors student, who said the thing that sold me was the labs, the space that was part of the tour of that visit. And so, as with any academic endeavor, we both went through some parallel process. I had some recognition for helping do the instruction for first-year students and integrating that. Luke was recognized as an honors scholar, and so this was unique in that it was an honors student who came through the transfer portal. That wasn't a transfer portal at that era. A transfer student who engaged in the honors program and was subsequently recognized in that regard, and so you can continue to find that YouTube channel story that Luke participated in. But as with any sort of student experience, it's this question of, could you tell me more about? And so Luke arrived in my office asking about my connection and my participation in Fermilab. And so for those that are unaware, it's our closest national lab to our campus here in DeKalb. Over 6,000 acres of a user facility where the goal is to explore accelerator science and detector technology. And so you see that the standard kind of picture of what we call the subatomic particles that are all in all high energy physics presentations. The one that I spend my great deal of time on is this muon, which is a heavier version of a negative particle, different than an electron, but having a little bit more mass that they study as part of the intensity frontier at Fermilab. And so that connection exists not only when we were doing research, but Luke is now an employee there, and I want to indicate how that parallel path moved forward for the two of us. I started out and per the Office of Research Development and working with SPA at that time, explored numerous grants, and these were small endeavors with Argonne, with Illinois Department of Ag, had a sponsored project on a cook stove that we took a team of students to DC for the Environmental Protection Agency. But then in doing so, that introduced, again, that collaboration across disciplines, working with the Department of Physics to be introduced to these two experiments that took place at Fermilab. Again, 5 or 6 years later, after I had arrived, Luke is progressing through this same sort of endeavor, knocking on doors, asking how we could support. And the important feature of that was the tiered mentoring. And so I want to highlight Udena Okafor, who was a master's student, who was the second student working with me on the MUDE project. He needed help. Luke was a willing undergrad interested in doing exactly that to help out. And then, as good Huskies do, they roll up their sleeves and they said, hey, could we do this as part of my curricular activity? And so in the lower right-hand corner, you see the result of Luke Martin's senior capstone to design a feature that was associated with the instrument feed-through bulkhead. And we'll come back to that again in a little bit. What happens is we all get to move in from that introduction into big things. And so I want to highlight some of the big activities that I did, and we'll talk about the same thing for Luke. The muon G-2 experiment was an endeavor initiated by Fermilab to try to explore a term that's called the anagolix moment dipole. And we won't dive into the science of it, but structurally what's taking place is there is a tracker. It's a bunch of straws that are canted. They're tilted at about 7.5 degrees so that you can watch the track of these high-energy positrons as they decay in the ring. And so working our way from the bottom of this image, something is going to have an orbit. It's going to penetrate each one of these straws, and so you need to be able to activate those straws in a high-intensity, high-vacuum environment in order to make that happen. And so our colleagues at the University of Liverpool helped build this tracker that was built up of hundreds of straws. We had 8 in the unit. We had to have backup units in order to make it work, make sure that the thing didn't burst, which was actually an undergraduate experiment that we did, where engineering was doing the supplied work of satisfying the thermal needs, the structural needs. If you walked your way down the path in the GoPro picture, there's a little carbon fiber in there. Someone had to define what the thickness of that carbon fiber was, what the strength was, that the entire thing wouldn't suck together in that way. And so it's all endeavors as part of research. And the thing that makes, what does NIU do for an investment? We built the first 32-channel tracker. We invested our time and energy. It was a machine shop in the College of Engineering and Engineering Technology. And so there's the prototype that was built, tested at Fermilab, and subsequently used for what's called a critical design review. It released additional funds to Fermilab to continue the experiment whilst I'm doing my job to graduate more students, run through more master's students so that they can move on into their careers. I couldn't find the pictures of the 30 undergraduates that helped advance it because it would overload the slide too much, but it's trying to do research at multiple levels. When we talk about it being a big thing, you have to collect numerous pieces of data, and so I was introduced to this project in 2012. You see that our release date of information was 2021, and so one of the things about, Richard talked about build a university and be patient. Let's build an experiment and be patient. What occurred, that picture of the standard model that I had a few slides ago predicts this value of this moment to be something on the order of 18 plus 10 to the 9 value. The experiment in Brookhaven in the the late 90s found that value was outside of that range, which is what drove kind of the interest. And so the first result was the piece that was released in April of 2021. It was our Mars lander moment to say, oh, indeed, there is new science that's outside the standard deviation of the prediction. And then we get to notoriety. Nature was interested in us. I'm keenly interested in cartoons, and so Jorge Cham, who writes Piled Higher and Deeper, highlighted us as a cartoon. But then ultimately, the realization is when the New York Times posts it, and then Luke Skywalker literally highlights your research, it makes you recognize that you're having a greater impact on that. We took that and continued to take more data. That tracker that was set to work for 2 years has ultimately worked for six. And so we've been able to accumulate more data, more statistics. We've narrowed those error bars and had a new release in August 2023. The important thing is, you know, continued recognition. And while we get that public recognition, the links on the bottom are kind of pointing out the citations. How many times within a peer-reviewed environment are you recognized? And the first one is recognized at this point 1,900 times, and something that's only at this point a year and a half old has already been cited over 500 times. It's the joy every morning of getting the email from ResearchGate saying another citation to the research and the work that you're doing. I talked about my big thing, and I talked about this being a parallel path for Luke's activity, and so Luke supported what is the muons to electrons experiments. This is a beam stop that you're trying to absorb any sort of energy, and so just like you have my kid plays baseball and needs a brick wall to throw that ball into in the middle of the winter, we need something that's going to absorb all of the energy of these high-energy particles. And so this is an enormous, and I say 4 meters long or 13 foot long, it's as long as our Board of Trustees table here, weighing over a couple of tons, but needs to be able to move and oscillate. And so you've got the arrows there indicating the kind of rotation and fluctuation, all being able to be able to push in and out of the experiment without disrupting the detectors or the other kinds of sensitive components. Like good Huskies, and I can't remember if it was Richard or someone talked about rolling up their sleeves and getting it done, Luke was the Husky that literally ran the experiment of making sure that this thing was going to push into the experiment. And this is all work that was done in 2016 when Luke was finishing his degree here at NIU. And as with all things, let's be patient. And so this past summer, they finally built the piece, and it is ready. It's wrapped in foil and ready to be installed in the experiment once some other pieces and components are produced. So Luke continues to be an engaged Husky. He's worked at Fermilab at this point for approaching 9 years. He continues to roll up his sleeves and talks about the different kinds of experiments, the different types of projects that he's set up with, and having that Husky outreach on it. And the part that I want to indicate is, what is that seed, what is that thing that we plant within our students? If you remember that tiny, tiny project that Luke did for a senior design project now 10 years ago, lo and behold, he took this picture for me 2 weeks ago and showed what it has turned into as an instrument feed-through bulkhead that's going to run thousands of channels, thousands of signals through it in order to satisfy the experiment. So at the beginning, it was an opportunity for Luke and I. Now it's transitioned into an opportunity that Luke and I get to offer to other students. And so I want to highlight a grant that Bart Sharp and I have developed within the Bart is in College of Business, working in management. We have this DOE-sponsored activity, Accelerating Underrepresented Engineering Careers through Accelerator Innovations. The goal here is, on a three-year grant, to invite students to participate, engage in numerous different research activities. But given Bart's entrepreneurial spirit, it's not to say, hey, here's the question we're going to answer sometime in 3 years. He says, what are we going to do in the next 6 months? And let's evaluate and reset whether we allocate our funds in that unique way. Needless to say, the Department of Energy, when they first read our proposal, said, this is very strange. This is not science. This is business. But we're really, really intrigued. But no. And so per that research development phase, this was the third iteration of aligning it with the right program officer, the right program, in order to make those things match, for which we're supporting current undergraduate and graduate students. In parallel, Luke, as I said, is now employed at Fermilab and looks at me and says, we need more of your students that are rolling up their sleeves that want to solve problems. And he helped establish this cooperative research and development agreement with Fermilab, which is now, numerous mentors being provided, numerous materials and supplies. As I was sitting here, I was reading through an email from the student team that was working with their advisor right now, saying, here's our prototype, we're ready to build, and so we'll talk about getting to see those things in May. But this is an in-kind activity that it's not dollars and cents, right? It's not helping our bottom line necessarily, but it is this clear engagement and commitment by partnership within the university to make that happen. So if we want to talk about what those measures are, I don't have a great number of journal publications. What I do have are numerous students that I can tell stories about that are fascinating. I spent the summer chatting with these students that were part of the cohort and the current grant. Some that are deciding, research is interesting, but I want to go back into industry to do these other things. Others are pursuing, where can I consider PhDs, either at NIU, or what's the foundation that I'm going to use from NIU to move forward. And of course, you're all invited to our showcase that's going to take place in May, on May 2nd, where all of the engineers show off their activities. It's design. Sometimes it's research, sometimes it's literally just solving a problem, but the reason I highlighted it is that it's that parallel story. This is the picture of Luke and I at last year's event, where it's no longer a faculty member and a student, it's a peer-to-peer now relating to one another, offering that opportunity of engagement and research for our current students. And so I'll finish with an acknowledgement of the numerous faculty in physics that help out with the Northern Illinois Center for Accelerator and Detector Development, a mouthful that we prefer to call NICAD. But I also want to highlight the staff from SPA that have helped out substantially. I've noted the particular staff in individual things, but I want to highlight Donna Martin in particular. This $850,000 grant that I have from the Department of Energy, I was told by the program officer, hey, you should pursue this other element. It was introduced to me in early February. I had put some pieces together and then somehow lost track of the date. I was teaching my 2 p.m. class, but a letter of intent was due at 4 p.m. that very same day, to which I raise an alarm to SPA. Donna amazingly put in that LOI by 3:55 p.m. in order to allow the rest of the process to happen. And so some kudos and applause to those folks in SPA that make the system work in the background. And so I have too many images of funding agencies and students to link into, but I'll open it up to questions that anyone might have. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
I mean, I will add that the showcase day for the College of Engineering on May 2nd,
mm-hmm.
I've been to that now twice, I think, and it is amazing.
It's I like to call it the science fair on steroids,
yeah.
Because it is the engineers that, they want to show you all of the amazing things that they've been working on for the past year. And I had a fascinating discussion with a student back in September, and they said, why are we doing this capstone experience? And they feel like it's just work that they may have done in an internship. And for those students that haven't had an internship, they need to have something they can point to as an experience while they're at NIU that talks about teamwork, that talks about project planning, that talks about budgets and all of those and elements when they're going to sit down for an interview. And for which you said, Trustee Wasowicz, getting to engage those students and see their enthusiasm to tell the world what's taking place, and whether it is boards of trustees or it's high school students that are being introduced, this is the experiences you get at NIU. It's an important endeavor and outreach that we do.
Yeah, highly suggested. Yes, Dennis.
I don't have a question, just a comment. I think when you look at what are the reasons why students come to NIU, it's because of this. I mean, being a research university to me is a tremendous competitive advantage for NIU, for our students, our faculty, our community. This is exciting stuff, and this is one of the many things that sets us apart. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Lee. I want to also commend your work and obviously your passion and enthusiasm for this as well. As a father, my oldest son, 20 years ago, was at the CMS, the Compact Muon Solenoid Experiment at mm-hmm. Fermi. And for 20 years, he's been trying to get me to understand physics better. And it still goes way over my head, but I can tell that this type of, in the fact that this device is being built, and is this still as part of the CMS experiment?
So my particular experiments are not within CMS, but I have pivoted to other elements of the accelerator at Fermilab. Mm-hmm. Much like a university, you have different divisions and different features. Every one of the physicists thinks their experiment is the one that's going to define the standard model, but it's also recognizing that it's working in balance of support in building that.
Yeah. I mean, he's since left muon research and is now working on gamma ray, part of the MAGIC project in the Canary Islands. But I mean, I hear from him how difficult it is. He's at the Max Planck Institute in Munich. How difficult it is to and these are long-term efforts and projects. And I want to commend your work and the work of these students to have this type of focus and commitment and elevate what NIU is doing in this, which will continue to gain additional recognition and additional momentum as the years go on. So thank you.
Well, my only request is for the patients on it, and so I mentioned this muon beam stop that took, at this point, 12 years to go from idea to build. I know Ben's here, and we're going to talk about promotion and tenure at some point in terms of changes. We need to make sure that there's patience as well in terms of evaluating faculty that are making these progress, that are graduating students that don't align to a, if we're chasing federal dollars and that's going to be a measure of our success in the environment that we're facing for the next however many years, it's going to be a challenge. And so I would love for that patience to kind of be displayed, not on a quarterly basis or an annual basis, but how do we look at it as those long-term investments, for sure.
Great.
Thank you.
Richard?
Thank you, Nick. And I just wanted to note that it's the work of Nick and a lot of the folks that you called out on NICAD. You mentioned that Fermi is the closest national lab to us. We're also the closest research institution to Fermi. And we have deep ties with Fermi. And we were fortunate enough to be in the call yesterday with Fermi leadership as part of the Fermi Forward. We're going to continue to deepen those ties. We have a commitment. Fermi Forward was awarded, and we were part of that. And that means our faculty and our students will have more access to Fermilab, and Fermilab will have more access to us, including continuing education for their career staff. So we're really excited about the work that's already happening and the prospect of broadening and deepening those relationships. And it's thanks to folks like you, Nick, and really impressive work.
And for what it's worth, while we are the closest research university to Fermilab, none of this is unique and requires Fermilab, and I would love for us to open doors to other endeavors. I have the benefit of getting a sabbatical for next spring, and I'm going to go knock on doors at Idaho and National Renewable Energy Lab and other places, because it doesn't just need to be a proximity thing for NIU to be able to contribute. We live in a Zoom world or an online meeting world where we can contribute and participate. How can we emulate that model at other outreach and other institutions, for sure?
Anyone else? Nick, thank you very much. Appreciate
thank
it.
You. Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
Are there any other matters requiring the board's attention today? Okay, hearing none, then the next meeting of the Research and Innovation Legal and Legislative Affairs Committee is May 8th. And I sure hope it's a heck of a lot warmer on May 8th than it is today. May I have a motion to adjourn the meeting?
So moved, Guerrero.
Second, Barcino.
We have a motion and a second. Mrs. Wright, will you please call the roll?
Committee Vice Chair Rita Athes?
Yes.
Trustee Dennis Barcima?
Yes.
Trustee John Butler?
Yes.
Trustee Veronica Herrero?
Yes.
Trustee Aiden O'Brien? Trustee Leland Strom?
Yes.
Committee Chair Eric Wasowitz?
Yes.
Board Chair Montel Gales?
Yes.
Thank you.
So this RILA meeting, which I may say is probably the most exciting RILA meeting I have been at since I've been on the board, and I've been on the board for 7 years. So it is now adjourned, and then it concludes the meeting. Thank you.
Was